Greetings, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Test 2 preparation class for the junior and senior high class of History at Our House, American History. So let's just go and dive into the test prep sheets and see what you have come up with. So, as you've noticed, there's a format change with regard to the facts practice. So this will be a constant feature of your tests, but it will change each and every time, and I will just kind of, you'll have to adapt, basically. The format changes because we need to be able to come at historical facts from a lot of different angles. And so it's nice when you have a painting that reminds you of a historical event, but typically when we encounter historical facts, we encounter them on the basis of when they occurred, so we need to know the dates. Or we think of something that happened, then we have to figure out when. So it's kind of going at it from different angles. So here we have, write a brief description of the key event, including its present-day significance, i.e., of course, so what? All right, let's launch into this. Number one, 3000 BC. Sophie, please. Ooh, wild. Nice done. Okay. All right. So, establishing monarchy as the norm and, well, the significance of this is how very special the United States is in history. Okay. Excellent. Circa 508 BC, circa 509 BC, please. Theo, go ahead.
Athens and Rome create the first democracy and republic. These are important because they are the first two alternatives to monarchy.
Okay. One word that you could add there to make it better would be, Athens and Rome create the first democracy and republic respectively. See, you know what that adds?
Yeah.
Right? It means that the order that you put them in was not a mistake, and that we know to associate Athens with democracy and Rome with republic. Right? Because otherwise it becomes, well, they both invented both, or which is it? Right? Okay. And then how did you state the significance?
These are the first two alternatives to monarchy.
Okay, but that, notice, Theo, that is not a present-day statement. Because you can say something was the first in this or that place, but that's just a fact about the past. So, can you think of a way to translate that a little bit into a present relevant statement? Why should we care?
These are also the two examples that the founding fathers called upon in order to create the United States of America.
There we go. Right. So, modern freedom is a reset. It's a rebirth of and based upon the precedents that these established for the founding fathers. Right. So if we have a society today and we enjoy all of these values, we need this awareness to support our understanding. And also, as it turns out, one of the things that I find most fascinating about this connection that we have to the Greeks and Romans is, so often in history, when there is this genius involved, when there is this originating thought involved, people have two ways of approaching it. Well, I won't just say two, but there are two kind of predominant ways of treating that. One is called classicism. Do you guys know what classicism is? It was a big part of the Dark Ages. It was also prominent during the Renaissance, but less so in the Renaissance. Classicism means you basically look to the past and you read what the ancients came up with. The classical example is what you are obsessed with as a classicist. You want to understand the classics. Okay, so classicism is something that people often experience with regard to Athens or Rome because they're so impressive and so interesting. But beyond that, you have to have your own critical humanism, which was the main part of the Renaissance, the most important part of the Renaissance, which was you gotta do your own thinking. And so the Greeks and the Romans made mistakes. So it's not enough to be a classicist when you were, and the founding fathers were not merely classicists. They weren't just interested in the classics. Oh, republic, democracy, how wonderful, we'll just copy those guys. They were saying, well, actually, they made lots of mistakes, and if we're going to create a successful example of freedom in modern times, we've got to learn from those and do better. So this, I call that kind of critical humanism, meaning you're doing your own thinking as a human being. And so yeah, one thing is about America is there's a fair amount of classicism in the way that people think, even about the Constitution, even about the founding fathers. There's a kind of classicism, and there's not enough critical humanism. So anyway, just my observation. Okay, circa 4 BC, number 3. Okay, Sophie, go ahead. Your volume is really low. Can you find a way to increase your sound? Okay, hold on a sec. I'm going to put my recorder closer to, because your voice is really low. Go ahead. Okay, there we go. The start of the most important religion in the world today, and the reason why our calendar is the way that it is. 476. All right, this is supposed to be getting reflexive here. Timothy.
Okay. The fall of Rome was the most devastating event in history, in parentheses, in my opinion. All that was left after it were a few tribes that only knew of monarchy, and they knew nothing of art. This period, called the Dark Ages, lasted all the way up to the 1400s.
Okay, now, you got into a little bit of a trap there in a number of ways. Two problems. One is, opinions don't go on tests. So, I'm not asking you for your opinion of 476. I'm asking you for what you know. And what you know is the fall of the Roman Empire. That's what goes on the test. Next, you got stranded in the past because you said that the significance of this is that the Dark Ages lasted until 1400. Well, Timothy, my follow-on question to you is, who cares? Do we live in 1400? No. We live in 2014. So you tell me that something happened in 1400, I don't care. Unless you can show me that there's a reason why it has anything to do with the world around me. So be careful. This is the whole challenge of understanding the relevance of historical facts. That's why I asked for, very specifically in the question, present day significance. So, this is a tough one, mind you. So, I'm not surprised, but we have talked about it. What's the present-day significance, Bria?
One of the present-day significances for that is now we don't live in a European-centric world. We just don't.
Be careful. We don't live in a Rome-centric world. Right? Because Rome fell. We don't speak Latin. Right? We live in a world that was globalized by Europeans. A world in which European civilization is the central civilization. Okay. It's America-centric, because America is the most powerful in everything. But basically, the Europeans are the one who globalized it. Okay. All right. So, Bria wants 1492 as well. Go ahead, Bria.
Okay, so Columbus finds America. Because of this, we have an American-centric world, not a European-centric world.
Okay. No, I'm sorry. That won't do. I'll tell you why. Because the discovery of America does not generate an America-centric world. What is it that generates the America-centric world? Rhea, think this through and tell me. What is it that generates an America-centric world?
Well, the fact that Columbus found it gave birth to all the different, well, the founding fathers, making one of the most important worlds, well, one of the most important countries in the whole world, the world depends on us because of our freedom to do so.
Okay, you're on the right track, and I always appreciate it when you strive, right? If your answer involves striving towards the answer, that's a good thing, Bria. So good job. But yeah, more straightforward answer would be, it's the creation of America and the quality of it, the nature of it that creates the America-centric world. It's 1776. America is as great as it is because of that. So that's the one. 1776 is the milestone, more than any other, that sets in motion the story of America. Now, Columbus makes that possible. So what we have in terms of Columbus in 1492 is his discovery makes possible the rise of the United States of America. Without it, there simply is no place for the English settlers to go, for them to get involved in wars and get taxed and rebel against that and make their own country. The story that we're going to be studying in the next segment, it just doesn't happen because there's no America. Not a thousand Leif Ericsons are going to make an America. So it's Christopher Columbus makes the founding of America possible by discovering America. That's the present-centric connection. It's kind of an indirect one. Now, you can also say globalization. So there's two. Right? Because of this, the Americas become connected to the rest of the world, which they weren't before. And now there's a place for Europeans to spread out into. And, well, Western civilization comes, and it has its winding, torturous story until the Founding Fathers say, no more, we want to start again. Okay, so those two milestones, by far the most important in modern history. All right, so we already got 1776, Declaration of Independence leads to the America-centric world. Okay, the freest country, greatest country in the world. All right, number seven. 9/11/2001. Theo?
Muslim terrorists destroy the World Trade Center. This is the beginning of the era we are living in, the war on terror.
Okay. Here we go. So, yeah. All right. Let's keep going. That's anchor facts. That's review is what all that stuff is. But review is good. Review is good. It's so interesting because I sense that some of these things still don't flow very well for you, which is okay. It's valuable to know that and to try to continue improving it. All right. Number eight, using at least three of the anchor facts. Oh, now we're going to get some interesting modifications to the answers are going to be more flowing here or involve some optionality. Explain how the birth of America is part of a rebirth of Greek and Roman ideas. All right, let's do it. Timothy.
Okay. When Menes-Narmer unified Egypt, he chose monarchy as his government, which would become the normal form of government and the only form of government up until circa 508 and circa 509 BC, when ancient Athens invented democracy and ancient Rome invented republic. Unfortunately, these ideas were lost when Rome became an empire and conquered Athens, and then ultimately fell in circa 476 AD. The idea was never tried again until the Founding Fathers made a hybrid of the two governments called the Democratic Republic. It is the most successful government in all of history.
Interesting proposal. Is that what it is? Is the United States a hybrid of the two, a Democratic Republic? Interesting, interesting. I'm not going to agree with that, Timothy, but I'm also not going to, we're not in a position right now to discuss that. So it'll be interesting to revisit that possibility. I don't think that it's quite right to say that America's a hybrid of Rome and Athens. So we're going to have to, I mean, in some regards it is, which is a very interesting thought. So in some regards it is. I don't know that I would put it that way. For the very reason, Timothy, because in essence, that characterization renders the founding of America into a kind of classicist act. If Roman and Athens were the ones with the ideas and the founders were just copying them, then yeah, you would probably then say America's a hybrid of Rome and Athens. But that fails to account for too many really important things that you're not aware of yet. So, gotta be careful. I'm sensing, Timothy, something very, very good in your thinking, but also perilous. So what I mean by good and perilous is that I'm sensing a desire to evaluate, a desire to have thoughts that involve judgment and weighing of things and so on. And certainly when we know enough of history, that becomes really crucial. There's no point in knowing about these things if we don't also judge good or bad. If we can't judge good or bad, then we can't look at the past and say we're gonna repeat the good and jettison the bad, right? There's no lessons there. There's no instruction. There's no value. So yeah, absolutely, you have to engage in that. However, the peril here, Timothy, and you're falling right into the cavern here, is that if you make evaluations without the proper context, then you'll get them wrong. So basically, it's premature to judge these things or to integrate these things without all of the necessary information. So absolutely crucial, for instance, Timothy, what you're missing, and you don't know you're missing, is that the founding fathers were the first politicians in the history of mankind to think on the basis of a new theory of politics called natural rights. And this was something that no one in Greece and no one in Rome had any clear idea of. This was entirely an 18th century phenomenon. It started with an English thinker named John Locke and others around him. And that was new. And that gave them a prism through which to observe the Romans and the Greeks and understand them better than they understood themselves. And thus, they didn't hybridize their work. They simply took what was good and jettisoned the rest. And so it wasn't merely a combination. There was a lot of throwing away. There was a lot of, no, the Greeks got this wrong. No, the Romans got that wrong. And so on and so forth. We've got to come up with our own original solution. So it's much, much more than a hybrid. So that characterization, Timothy, is something that you, basically, it's perilous to do that at this level. So my advice to you, Timothy, is don't stop aspiring to that, but we have two examples on this test prep alone. Be careful, because it's so very easy to prematurely come to these conclusions and judgments. And that doesn't do you any good, because now you start to get into the realm of, well, oh, it's my opinion, as you kind of put it before. And, well, that doesn't do you any good, because your opinion is wrong. And so it's a process. It's a disciplined and difficult process, and you're on the right track, but try to maintain discipline in terms of sticking with what you know. That'll get you further. You'll be in a better place later on to have a judgment that is reasoned and fully contextual, and then you won't have to say, "Oh, it's my opinion." You'll be able to say, "I know how to back this up. Here's all the information that I have to back this up in full context." It'll be a real bona fide judgment. Okay. All right. Enough on that. Enough on that. Very interesting. So number 9. What Italian merchant inspired the explorers of the Age of Discovery? What part of the world did European explorers want to reach? And why? Because of him. Theo, go ahead.
The Italian merchant that inspired the Age of Discovery is Marco Polo. European explorers wanted to reach Asia because along with valuable jewels and spices, Marco Polo brought back tales of incredible riches in Asia, and he was not lying.
Yeah, they definitely thought he was a liar, and didn't they call his book A Thousand Lies or something like that? But anyway, now keep in mind, Theo, that when you're talking about the incredible riches of Asia, the truth is Asia was no more wealthy than any other part of the world. They didn't have any industrial revolution over there. They weren't walking around with their iPads at the time and automobiles and everything else. They were just like everybody else. What was the difference? Why did Marco Polo think that China was so significant? Why was there this perception of wealth? Because this is another interesting issue. What was special about China? King?
They were unified, and they had the king, the emperor, was able to sort of aggregate all of the wealth across this massive empire into one place.
Exactly, exactly. China was a unified empire. It was about 3 times the size of Europe. It was huge. And therefore, the emperor had the ability to gather together, Keane used the word aggregate, all of that wealth. If you take the wealth of 1 million people and you tax 5% and you make a pile, well, the pile is a certain size. If you take the wealth of 50 million people and put that into a pile, well, the pile's way bigger. Now, are those people any richer? No, they're just 10 times as many of them. Or however, I can't remember the numbers I was using. All right, but so that's the thing, is that it's really interesting because, and in fact, again, just to give you a little bit more detail, when the British arrived and started to press China for trade, if you do an analysis of the relative wealth of the British versus the Chinese, the British were already on what we say a per capita basis. In other words, a per person basis. The wealth of the average British person was already, I can't remember if it was 3 or as high as 7 times greater than the wealth of the average Chinese person already in the 18th century. So why did Britain want to trade with China? They were already at least 3, but I think it might be 7 times as rich as the Chinese. Well, because there was a huge country there with a huge base of people doing stuff. Individually, they weren't up to much, but there were a lot of them. And so it's just a quantitative issue. And that is the case today as well. China is a huge country. The people there are not nearly as rich as Americans. And yet, because the population is something like 3 times the size of America, even though the wealth of the average Chinese person is maybe 20% of that of an American, well, it's getting pretty darn near about the same when you add it all up. So everybody's trying to guess when China's economy, which is on superchargers, is going to grow larger than America's. That would be a very interesting moment in history. I don't think it's going to happen, but that's my own personal sense of things. I don't think that China's efforts are sustainable, especially if you look at what the Chinese are doing in terms of pollution. It's just absolutely staggering, and I don't think they'll be able to keep it up. It's just too destructive to their own well-being to be racing ahead like this. So we'll see. It'll be interesting. Anyway, we will definitely live in interesting times. So, number 10. Why is 1415 an important date in the Age of Discovery? What happened in that year? explain its significance in relation to at least three of the anchor facts. Notice what we're starting to do here. This is going to be a feature of the course for sure. Integration. Explain an event in terms of the context. Connect it. Make sense of it. Right? So who's ready to brave this question? Who's got something on this one? Did you try it, Ben?
Yeah.
All right.
In 1415, Prince Henry of Portugal led an expedition to conquer the Muslim city of... How's that pronounced?
Ceuta.
This continued the enmity between Europeans and Muslims and eventually led to the attack on the World Trade Center in 2001. Prince Henry discovered that Ceuta was part of a trading network that extended into Africa. He then established a school of geography and exploration on Portugal, jump-starting the Age of Discovery.
Okay, I only heard one anchor fact in there, am I right?
Well, hang on, there's more, hang on.
Okay.
jump-starting the Age of Discovery, which led to Columbus discovering America. So I did only have two, but that's more than one.
Okay, yes it is. Two is more than one, okay. Now, don't forget to put the dates, all right? When you are referring to anchor facts, you should definitely say the discovery of America in 1492. Okay, so who can help Ben out here? He's done well, so he said, all right, he's made a connection, right? That Westerners and the people of Islam, and especially in Africa and the Middle East, of course, have long been at odds, have long had religious wars. And the latest war on terror is part of it. It's a very strange one because modern America is not essentially a religious civilization as Europe once was. But it's very different. And it's caused Americans to have kind of not be sure how to fight this war. Because we don't have the mentality of the people of the Crusades or the people of the Reconquista. We don't think that way anymore. And we would rather just have a society of religious freedom, thanks to the founding fathers. But that is a very interesting problem, because if you want to have religious freedom, but one of the religions says kill everybody else with the other religions, then, well, now you have a problem, right? And you've got to deal with that properly, which is very challenging. And certainly, of course, people who are Muslims don't all agree on what Islam represents, just like Christians don't agree on exactly what Christianity has to say. That makes it even more complicated. And Americans are living among, many Americans, something like a million or so are Muslims, and they're living in peace with people in the United States. So, I mean, my goodness, this is a difficult problem. So that's a good connection between Ceuta and 9/11. That's a long-range connection. Ceuta and 1492, that's a very evident connection. What else? What else can we connect it to? There isn't a single one that we can't connect it to, so what would it be? Somebody help me with a connection to... Well, Ben, you want to try?
Yeah, I think I got it.
Okay.
He conquered the Muslim city of Ceuta, which connects to Mene's Namur and monarchy, and the idea of conquering.
Yeah, that's right. So that's a good one. So we would say, in that case, what we're talking about is Prince Henry belonging to the ruling dynasty of Portugal, and the basic conduct that people have towards each other in monarchies is... Right? Conquest, especially different people of different nations. So yeah, this is definitely an act that is related to this premise, right? And so you could also connect it to 476 by saying, well, Prince Henry is a ruler of Portugal. This contest between these Muslims who are from North Africa, which used to be in the Roman Empire, and Portugal, which used to be in the Roman Empire. Well, that's possible because the Roman Empire has collapsed. And we have these people of different tribes and different religious beliefs that are now in different parts of what was Rome before, and they're fighting each other. So we could connect it to 476 as well. And so, can we connect it to 1776? Not as easy, but we can. Anybody pull it off? What would you say? What would be a connection to 1415 and 1776? There definitely is one. Quite direct. Theo, what do you think?
Prince Henry the Navigator was an explorer. And I think probably partly inspired the Spanish king and queen into letting Columbus go on his voyage to the Americas.
Okay, so now that's a connection between 1415 and 1492 again. But I'm trying to say, can we build a bridge between 1415 and 1776 more quickly than that, more directly than that? There is a bridge between them. Because Prince Henry's not so much an explorer as, well, a kind of Renaissance geographer slash leader of exploration. So, do you see the connection? Prince Henry is one of the early representatives of the Renaissance. And so, and the founding fathers are responsible for the rebirth of the political ideas of the ancient world, in the same sense that Prince Henry is responsible for the rebirth of not only the scientific geography of the Greeks, but of the method of exploration. So there we go. We connected it to 1776 as well, through the theme of the Renaissance. Is it connected to Athens and Rome, 509, 508? That would be about the only one that would be pretty difficult to connect directly. I don't know that I would be able to do that. Doesn't seem like it would work. Okay, but that's the method, right? You're looking for a connection like one that is part of the same theme, part of the same idea, a conflict between Western civilization and Islam, so that would be the connection to 9/11. Then you'd have the connection via the Renaissance or rebirth of ancient ideas. That would be 1776. Connection through the Age of Discovery. That would be the connection to 1492. A connection to monarchy. That would be 3000 BC. A connection to tribalism and the wars between the people within the former Roman Empire. That's 476. Okay. So that's the method. That's the application. There'll be more of those, so prepare for it. All right, number 11. What are three competing views concerning the discovery of America? Why is Columbus's voyage of 1492 by far the most important discovery in American history? Sophie, go ahead. Okay. Did you say that's the most widely accepted view? No, you got really... Oh, I really wish you would get a different microphone or different setup. I can't hear you well. But it's, I don't know if it's the most widely accepted view. Either people are ignorant and don't have a view, or a lot of them today are completely against the view that Columbus discovered America and only want to say bad things about him. So yeah, no, we're in an era of, in history, what's called revisionism. And so revisionism means breaking down old thoughts and trying to replace them with something else. We're far into the story of revisionism now. Bria, go ahead.
I was just going to add, we don't have, our country is not named after Columbus, it's named after Amerigo Vespucci.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, I mean, that's not anybody's fault nowadays. That was the geographer Waldseemüller and others like him who adopted the description of America by Vespucci, who kind of snuck in there in front of Columbus on the maps. So, yeah, that's something else. That's not really for this particular question. Okay, number 12. What was Columbus's idea about reaching Asia? What does the following map show us about his idea and why he was wrong in a good way? Okay, so let's see here. Who hasn't had a chance yet? Erica, how about you?
I'm sorry, I haven't done the thing yet. I'm just here for the prep.
Okay. But do you understand that the prep is, to be here for the prep means to have your answers prepped? Okay, but you aren't in a position to do it. Okay, what about you, Piper? Piper, are you there? Okay, Piper is not available either. Okay, Timothy, go ahead.
Okay. what Columbus wanted to do was sail down to the Canary Islands in Africa, then sail straight to the west and first run into Antilla, a fake island people thought might be real. then keep sailing west and hit Cipangu, modern-day Japan, and eventually hit Cathay, modern-day China. However, he did not reach Antilla, and his crew got very weary and frightened. He had to trick them into thinking they hadn't been sailing as long as they thought. Eventually, he hit the Bahamas, which at first he thought was Cipangu, and unknowingly sparked the eventual birth of the greatest country in history.
Okay, right. Yeah, now he didn't think that the Bahamas were Cipangu. He had, as you can tell with Toscanelli's map here, you have this vague awareness of an archipelago, which means a large collection of islands, of which Cipangu was the greatest. So when he got to this small island of San Salvador, he knew very well it wasn't Cipangu, and he expected Cipangu to be an established civilization on top of that. So when you've got just naked primitive natives running around, you know you're not in Cipangu yet. And so he just kept asking them questions. They sent him south. If they had sent him further west, well, then he would have got straight to Florida. But they sent him south, and so he ended up in Cuba. And, well, he just kept looking. And so he thought he was in the surroundings of Cipangu, but didn't know where he was exactly. Okay, so the map shows us he was wrong in a good way, because as it turns out, the Americas are where he thought the edge of Asia was, approximately. So that's the key to his fortuitous mistake, is that the Americas are pretty much where he thought the edge of Asia would be. And so he was wrong in a good way. Wrong in a good way. Okay, number 13. What was the Treaty of Tordesillas of 1494? What country's fate was sealed by this arrangement? Sophie, go ahead.
The Treaty of Tordesillas gave Spain the right to explore the world to the west of a line in the Atlantic Ocean. Portugal had the right to explore the other half of the world. Brazil was destined for Portugal and the Philippines for Spain.
There we go. Okay, you got two countries there. So yeah, as it turns out, because of the miscalculation, Brazil was on the Portuguese side, or at least an important part of it. And then, yeah, as it turns out as well, when Magellan ended up on the other side of the planet, he wasn't sure if, well, the Philippines were on his side or the other side. So, all right, let's take them. And nobody really knew until it was pretty much too late. And so, yeah, we'll see that the Philippines are part of the Spanish Empire until, guess what? Until America takes it away from them. So, we'll get to the Philippines later on. Okay, 14. What were the three main forms of Christianity that arose during the Age of Discovery? What did they have in common? All right, Theo, please.
The three main forms of Christianity that arose during the Age of Discovery were Lutheranism, Anglicanism, and Calvinism. What these three forms of Christianity had in common were that they all have their roots in Catholic Christianity. They also all needed a ruler in order to prosper.
Okay, interesting answer. All right, so when you say the roots in Catholic Christianity, what it says, they are all departures from Catholic Christianity. How about that? That would be a little bit more of a historically correct statement. They, each of them needed the support of rulers at the time in order to succeed. That's our old cuius regio thought there, indeed. But also, in the sense that they were departures from Catholic Christianity, what's the common denominator? Right? Luther would not look at Henry VIII or any of his descendants and say, yes, I agree with him. And Calvin disagreed with Luther, and he wouldn't have had anything good to say about Henry VIII either. So they're all looking at each other, and they don't agree with each other. But what do they have in common, which is part of this crucial importance of the event, of this phase of history, Bria?
They did not want O king to rule their religion.
Nope, not so. I mean, cuius regio just says exactly the opposite. It says, whatever the ruler chooses, the people's religion is going to be. And Luther knew that he needed the support of the lords. And so, and Calvin as well, acted in lots of ways like a king in Geneva. And they had people executed and stuff. Not so. So we're not talking about people who understand freedom of religion. That comes later. So, Ben.
They all rejected the ideas of the Pope.
Yeah, they're all anti-Pope, is the essence we're talking about. So one phrase for this particular period is the Protestant Revolt. Protestant is a good term in the sense that it captures all of these different beliefs in the sense that they're all protesting against the papal view of Christianity. So that's a common denominator. They're all Protestants. So, yeah, other than that, yeah, there's certainly other common denominators. So, Theo, you were right. In what you said, so I would accept different forms of the answer here. And certainly with regard to Luther and Calvin, they had other things they agreed on and disagreed on. So that's kind of tricky, but Anglicanism is definitely the odd man out there, so we have to be careful that they did not all have things in common. Anglicanism certainly did not propose some of the ideas that Luther and Calvin agreed on. So that's the thing. The common denominator here is they were against the Pope. And this is really, really important because European civilization was every country in Europe that was Christian agreed. The Pope is in charge. And that makes for a certain unity. And if the Pope is in charge, and if the Habsburgs can take over, then we're going to have a European empire. We're going to have a single, unified European civilization. But just as the Habsburgs are trying to take over, and they're growing their power, we get this breakup. So we get religious diversity within Christendom, and now it's not possible anymore. Cuius regio, and off we go into the world, and it's never going to be unified. And religious wars, and so on. Priya, what did you want to say?
Nothing.
Commenting on your knowledge. Oh, okay. All right, I didn't catch it, though, so... Anyway, all right, so explain the outcome of the Schmalkaldic War in relation to at least three anchor facts. Oh, there we go again. All right, we did this one in class, so that should have been feasible, although I'm sensing a few people didn't get to it. Ben, how did you do on this one?
Answer.
You didn't do this one, okay. I'm sensing we're at the fringe of everybody's efforts here. With 3 days, you guys couldn't pull this off? Theo?
Okay, The outcome of the Schmalkaldic War is Cuius Regio Ius Religio. This means that the ruler chooses a religion for the people. The earliest documented example of this being in Mene's Marmor. In this circumstance, all of the religions are variations on Christianity, which is based on the birth of Christ in 4 BC. The beginning of the end of this practice is in 1776 AD, when the founding fathers separate church and state in the Declaration of Independence.
Beautiful answer. Wow, you guys hear that? That was awesome. That was a great answer. Yeah, great, great job. So we're tying, I love what you did. You tied it back to Mene's Narmer. So talking about monarchy, the ruler gets to choose. And the monarchs in ancient Egypt were pharaohs. They're the gods on earth. So everybody has to do what they say in every regard. So here we go now, but we're in Europe. And so you could have used 476 for that, right? But never mind, you did perfectly fine. So you said, all right, we're in Christian times. So if we're going to have rulers dictating, it's going to be variations of Christianity. Excellent. And then we can finally get past this when we're in 1776 and the founders say, no rulers in religion. No more. The government shall make no law concerning an establishment of religion. Separation. Freedom. Fantastic. All right, nicely done, Theo. That's the way to do it. So everybody, go back and re-listen to Theo's answer if you want to understand how to do these questions. He's nailed it. Okay. Number four. What were the names of Columbus's three ships? So this is just the fun stuff at the end when you've done all the hard work. Nobody should be able to answer. Actually, you guys don't get to answer these. You know why? Because, wait, Theo gets to answer them. Because he's the only one who gave me an answer for 15. So that's, you can't get the bonuses if you didn't do the other questions. Theo?
16 is the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria.
Okay.
17 is the Schmalkaldic League.
Okay.
18 is, the name for Japan was Sepangu.
Mm-hmm.
And China was Cathay.
All right. Nicely done. All right. Bonuses are bonuses. All right. So this is getting a little bit harder, right? Can you sense that the difficulty level went up a bit from test one? So yeah, it is. It is, but I also sense it's on the edge of your capabilities, which is good, and so you need a little bit of a carrot there. You need to see something in front of you that's a little bit more difficult than you've done before, and to motivate you to get onto it. So, good, I'm also sensing it's going to be a good stretch for you. So, Ben and Theo in particular had answers to these anchor fact questions, which were a little bit harder, and they're giving you a good sense of what you need to do with those. Okay? So, all right. Pretty good. Pretty good. I hope next time I'll have participation from a few more people than this time. But other than that, not so bad. All right. So, that's it. We have a long break. So, good luck with the test. And, enjoy your Thanksgiving. I hope you have a great Thanksgiving. Keen, go ahead.
Yes. What is the time gap in between when this test is signed and then when it's due for me?
Oh, I'll be generous on this. Let me know by email if you have any constraints on your time. Usually when I give you a test on a Thursday, I want it back by Monday or Tuesday. And I think that's probably a good idea. But so maybe by Wednesday, right? Because you don't want to be doing any work on Thursday or Friday, or so maybe I'll make it Wednesday just to give you an extra day because it's a nice break, something like that. Just let me know if that works for you. I'll be pretty open to it. Okay. Anything else? Okay. Looking forward to returning and revisiting the story of America. Bye, folks. Have a good break.